Welcome to episode 3, season 2 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
Well, tonight we've got a bit of a treat. We've got 3 films which have seemingly tried to be look like they've been shot in one take. So that's why it's a one take wonder episode.
Indeed. And so we've chosen 3 films that actually are one-take wonders, or as Ricardo says, you know, pretend to be. Mm-hmm. And what we thought we'd do is a bit of a treat, or maybe even a challenge for ourselves, and we're both very nervous about this, is see if we can do this particular podcast episode in one take itself.
Yes.
Normally we cut out the ums and ahs, or where we get a bit hysterical. Something incredibly witty we think we've said, but we'll give it a go.
Well, let's give it a go.
So the films we're going to do tonight are Hitchcock's Rope, made in 1948. Then we're going to talk about Alexander Sokurov's Russian Ark. And then we're going to talk about Birdman from only a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So, Ricardo, why don't you get us going by talking about Rope?
Okay, Rope. Based on the 1929 play by Patrick Harrison and released in 1948... Rope is a psychological thriller about two seemingly intelligent young men and possible lovers, Brandon Shaw, John Dahl, and Philip Morgan, Farley Granger, who strangle to death their inferior classmate, David Kentley, Dick Hogan, in their apartment, hide the body in a wooden chest, then surprisingly challenge themselves by inviting the victim's family and friends, including his father, aunt, fiancé, and even her former lover, to dinner, seeing if they can get away with it. If they do, it would be the perfect murder. They also daringly invite their prep school housemaster, publisher Rupert Cadell, James Stewart, and this is where the fun begins. Everybody questions throughout the night about the whereabouts of David, and Rupert begins to get suspicious. Philip starts acting fidgety, and Rupert starts to see that something is not as it seems. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock, this was the first film he made in colour, and it was also his most experimental, ambitiously trying to make the film look like it was just one take. Look, Rope is a very good thriller from the master of suspense, which also examines psychopathic tendencies and the makeup of a fascist philosophy in a social context of a modern upper class, which is scarily quite current in itself. What did you think about this film, Greg?
I'm still processing words like fascist, sociopathic and upper class.
Well, it was a bit like that.
And it's interesting that you say, you know, that these two young guys set themselves a challenge about this dead body. It makes our challenge look like nothing. But, look, it's interesting. This is the second time I've seen this film. You've seen it before?
I had seen it before, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it at the movies.
Not for a long time, though.
Yeah, a long time ago. But because this time I was watching it in the context of One Take Wonders, I was, I think, that much more attuned to how does he do it.
Yes.
And it's interesting. He makes two types of cuts to mask the fact that he's making cuts. Mm-hmm. And I only remembered one sort of them. So the one I remembered, which is actually quite clumsy, is that he zooms right in on the back of someone.
So he does.
You have a close-up of someone's dark jacket.
Yeah, it masks the whole frame go to black, and which means he can actually...
And then he cuts to that same thing.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And starts the next, you know, 10-minute sequence. And I remembered that, although it was clumsier than I remembered. What I've forgotten about is that the other half of the cuts are actually your more traditional cuts. Mm. He's focused on someone, he cuts, and he then focuses on another character. But what he does, which is clever, and I think why you less notice and I forgot, is that either side of that cut are two linked comments in a conversation. Mm. So although the visual cuts, the audio thread, keeps going. And so the first lot I actually found really quite clumsy. The second lot, so skillful because I'd forgotten. But I was also much more aware this time of some of the really clumsy shots where the camera is focused on someone while somebody else is talking.
That's right.
And I don't think it's to kind of, in most cases, to highlight something. It's more just to have the two people in focus so he can do his, you know, cutless movie. And a couple of times I noticed the camera would kind of do a sweep down a row of people to get from person A to person B. And so I think on reflection, Hitchcock set himself a challenge that he didn't quite meet. So he certainly met it in terms of giving the appearance of this, you know, cutless film. But sometimes the mastery I would normally associate with Hitchcock film wasn't there because he had this other objective in mind. So I found it quite interesting. What about you?
I find it, pretty much I think it's like a theatre piece. It was a play. So I feel like, you know, and we'll talk about the other films as well, but I feel like I'm watching a theatre show. And I think theatre itself, when it's filmed, doesn't look great when you watch it back. I always feel like when you watch a theatre show, you know, because all the acting is way over the top. And I still think that's a bit of a problem here. I think some of the performances are way too over the top. In fact, I found the two guys, I think...
Farley Granger and John Dahl, is it?
Yeah, I found them really way over the top and really theatrical. I felt like I was watching a film theatre play. It's only when Jimmy Stewart came in that I really thought the film starts kicking off.
He comes in 28 minutes in.
I know.
The film's heading towards halfway over.
It is. I know. But I think that's a problem. But I think the film works in a lot of ways. I think it does, and I think its setup is okay. But I think, you know, it does have that issue there. And I think sometimes the technical can get in the way of performance.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I had the opposite response. I was aware how late in the film Jimmy Stewart comes in, and this is Jimmy Stewart's first film for Hitchcock. You know, he did a number, obviously, following Rear Window and Vertigo, at least. And I occasionally found his performance a bit over the top, you know, before the big conversation at the end. A couple of times I thought, oh, that's interesting. I thought that was a bit overplayed. Whereas I didn't mind the two main guys in how they played it. I actually thought the worst performance of the night was David. His death was so unbelievable. You know, he's strangled, and it's kind of like, it's almost like they just, I don't know what they've done, but it doesn't look like a death to me.
Well, it's that cut, because it shows, it's actually got a shot of the exterior of the place first and foremost.
With
and
a then screen that doesn't sound like a strangled
it
screen.
It doesn't sound like a strangled, it goes, no, it doesn't.
It's not even that good.
No, it's not. No, but yeah, no, I agree with that, but still, you've still got somebody being strangled and then put in, you know. I thought that probably one of the worst performances was Farley Granger as Philip.
Why?
I think he's so over the top and so obvious in the whole film and so fidgety and I feel like no wonder anybody questions him or something that's gone wrong. I really do, yeah.
And you felt the same way about John Dahl?
Not John Dahl. As
Brandon?
Oh, a little bit, yeah, a little bit. Not as much.
I thought his performance was really good.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there thinking, what did he do after this? Because it's not a name that you know. Farley Granger did Strangers on a Train for Hitchcock, for example, and I know he's done other things without actually knowing what they are.
Yeah.
John Dahl's not a name I think I know in any context except this film, and yet I thought he carried off really quite well.
Look, I think this is the style of the acting of the time as well. I think, you know, you had that really theatrical where you know, actors were going from theatre to film and doing most of their work in the theatre, so learning the craft of film acting was a bit different. So I think some directors like Kubrick, you know, when you watch his early movies, they don't have that. He could direct those actors to be quite realistic and have a sense of realism. Whereas this was very theatrical. I did feel like I was watching a play, but I think that is the form of the one take, I think. I think, you know, in terms of going in and out, I think we talked about it the last episode as well with White Christmas. There was a lot of shots where they just move in and out and you can set this one shot and create different shots in that. I think, you know, it works, and I think Rope is very good, but
I was doing a bit of reading around this film, and I hadn't realised why he did this particular film in one cut, or supposedly one cut. Because, as I understand it, what he was trying to do was to replicate the sense in the theatre that there was no possibility that the body was anywhere else than in the chest. So at the start of the actual, you know, stage play, I would imagine you see David throttled, put in the chest, and then he's there until the end. Whereas in a film, because you can cut and show other scenes, you know, in that more traditional style of filmmaking, there's always, in Hitchcock's view at least, there's always this view that the body, maybe the body's not really there after all. And he wanted that sense of impending discovery, dread, things falling apart by making it feel like a stage play.
Yeah.
And you know, I really admire the craftsmanship.
Oh, in 1948. I mean,
all through these films, you know, the craftsmanship and the choreography that would have been required of actors, camera, other technicians would be something to behold.
Oh, it is. It's quite an amazing feat. And of that time, I mean, the cameras at the time could only film 10 minutes at a time, so he had to get around it and do something. And I thought he did it very well, you know, for
that time. I found it a bit clumsy at times, but I still really admire that.
But I still think it was the first time someone had actually attempted to try and do this, really. I can't think of another film that's tried to do it. And I think now, especially, you know, the film when we talk about Birdman, I mean, they really try and replicate, and they did a few of the techniques in that from Rope. So I think it was a very, very...
Well, films, even not the three films we're talking about, but other films that have, you know, a sustained long take somewhere in them, like... Atonement, like Godard's, I think it's called The Weeknd, and there are many others.
Yeah, there are. There are.
Boogie Nights.
Yeah, Boogie Nights, The Player, you know.
Exactly.
Snake Eyes, Brian De Palma.
Yeah,
you know,
so it's almost a kind of, I wouldn't want to go as far as saying it's a fad, but it's a thing that directors will do now. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone even did that before 48. Before
no,
that was the first in that respect.
Yeah, yeah, I can't think of it. So therefore, you know, if some of it is clumsy, well, you know, I forgive it for that.
That's very good of you, Carlo. I'm sure Hitchcock would be very pleased. And, you know, there are things about this that I love that are very classical Hitchcock things, and I'm thinking of three things. The first one is that grim, you know, fascination with death that has humour in it. So this time around, I was much more aware of the number of times people were using death language that really stood out. So things like, you know, killing two birds with one stone, how to keep the body beautiful when it's the body that's starting to decay in the chest, basically.
Yeah.
I could really strangle you, Brandon. I'm like the grave. There's a lot of that sprinkled all through the script, which may or may not have been the original stage play. I don't know. The second thing was that really Hitchcockian way that he imbues a very everyday household object with a deeper meaning. In this case, in particular, the piece of rope.
Yes.
So the rope is, you know, just an ordinary piece of rope, but, you know, we know from the start of the film this is actually the murder weapon.
It is.
And it's not only being used by Brandon, John Dahl's character, to be... I'm trying to think of a polite way of saying a rude word, a clever dick, shall we say.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's having fun with the whole thing, not realising he's also digging the hole for the two guys, as well as, what's Farley Granger's character called?
Philip.
Philip. That he's doing it the way that he's just not coping in general with it all. Hmm. But the rope also is something that Jimmy Stewart picks up on, his character Rupert. It's the thing that he uses to unnerve them at the end. So,
yes.
So the rope in particular, but even the chest and the glass that Farley Granger breaks in his hand at one point.
Yes,
I think it's a martini glass.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And then the third thing is the sequence I've forgotten, which I thought was just so typically Hitchcock, is that at the end of the dinner party, the housekeeper, is it Mrs. Wilson?
Yes.
Yeah, Mrs. Wilson, is just working in the background, clearing away the chest.
Yes.
And while the while all the other characters in a circle talking to each other, pretty much off screen.
Yeah, and she's just
we're watching
that.
Her along the length of the two rooms.
We are.
Just going about her business. And at some point, the penny drops for us that, oh, she's about to do something with the chest.
Yeah.
She's about to commit the act of discovery while everyone's there.
Exactly.
And that feeling of almost dread or anticipation.
Our focus, your focus, was not even on those conversations.
I couldn't tell what they were talking about.
You couldn't. I can't either, right? Because you're focused completely on what she's doing. He's an absolute master, Hitchcock.
I also enjoyed there was that little sequence between David's aunt and his girlfriend, almost fiancé, and then the Jimmy Stewart character that was little arch digs about, you know, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman.
Yes.
In the things you know, oh, was that movie called The Something About Something?
Yeah.
No, I think it was just called The Something.
Mm.
And all those little jokes about, you know, so they're obviously referring to Notorious with Bergman and Cary Grant and so on. So I love that kind of, you know, playfulness that's going on in the film as well.
I think this film is very playful. I think it tries to be the two protagonists, the two you know, in terms of its, you know, because they're quite funny, they're quite hilarious, and possible lovers. I think that this film was banned in a few states because of because it was quite
the homoerotic implications.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
and you know,
doesn't mention it once.
No.
You know,
and I kind of wonder if I hadn't been primed for that would I have been picked up on it, or would I have just seen a relationship that kind of trapped in guilt?
Oh, I picked
up on
it.
And mutual, like, self-congratulation.
I picked up on it, though. I thought, are they lovers? I thought that when I started watching it again, because I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't seen Rope for a very long time. But I started thinking, are they lovers? And then it was only afterwards when I started reading up about, oh, wow, that was actually banned in a few states because of it. I thought, wow, how could that be banned? They don't even mention it once. There's no referring to them being lovers at all. It's really interesting.
Well, and the other thing is, if you want to situate this film in its, you know, historical context...
It's very subtle, yeah.
...is the play was written in 1929. Hitchcock films it almost 20 years later, but he films it in the context of, you know, World War II finished 2-3 years earlier.
Yes.
I'm not a history student, but I imagine that's around the time the Nuremberg trials were going on. And this idea that people might kill for almost intellectual reasons, like the Nazis, basically.
Well, that's where the whole fascism thing comes
this, this
in,
was
you know?
Very much, you know, a film of its time.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Just going back to the idea of playfulness, you know, we can't talk about a Hitchcock film without saying, did you spot his appearance?
Of course, you know, he's in the Neighbours, there's a shot of him in the exterior.
No.
That's him, isn't it?
No, it's not. And this, again, I thought that was right as well. Again, I was doing a bit of a reading.
That is him.
No, well, at the very start, during the credit sequence.
No, he's seen isn't he seen in the Neighbours section? He's like doing something in the background.
What's no. That? He's not there. You know that famous cartoon silhouette of him?
It's a silhouette.
Yeah, it's a neon sign.
Yeah. Ah.
A red neon sign that appears just about the time most of the guests are leaving the party.
Oh, right.
Very late in the film.
That's very subtle, isn't it?
It is very subtle. If I hadn't read it, I don't think I would have picked up on it. I thought he was actually in the street in the pre-credit sequence. You know, there's a couple of people walking down the street.
Yeah.
And that apparently was what a lot of people thought for a while, but apparently it's not him. It's one of his joke appearances. It's like the one in Lifeboat where he's on the newspaper ad for weight loss.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Oh, well, I know I'm diverging here a bit, but in Lifeboat, the whole film is set in a lifeboat after a ship has been torpedoed by a U-boat during the Second World War. And there are only something like 8 characters on this lifeboat. So in that story, unless you show the sinking of the ship, how do you show Alfred Hitchcock? And the way he got around it was one of the characters early in the film was reading a bit of newspaper. And on the front of the newspaper, for us to see, is a before and after shot for a weight loss program. And he's the before shot.
Oh, wow.
So it's like that. It's not really him, it's a representation of him, but it's a great solution to him appearing in a very constrained context.
Yeah, right. Well, what are you going to give this film, Greg? What's your
considered opinion?
Considered opinion. What is... I mean, we're Hitchcock fans. I mean, you're a Hitchcock fan.
I am.
Hitchcock fan. I'm a Hitchcock fan, but what instead of the Hitchcock realm, what would you give this?
For me, this is 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of his great films. I mean, for me, his great films are probably the ones that came afterwards and not straight afterwards. For me, the great ones are things like Spellbound, Vertigo, Rear Window, The Birds. I think it's probably Psycho, we talked about last year. Those North by Northwest, that classic kind of Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant era for me.
Yeah.
And I know this is a Jimmy Stewart film. I'm not even, so long since I've seen Notorious, I'm not even sure how I sit with that one. But those ones, a little bit after this for me, are the really, really great Hitchcock films. This one's got a bit of clumsiness for me, as I said, and it is a bit stagey and constrained, but I have to give it full marks for, particularly for its time, of what's done technically, so I think a 7.
Yeah, look, I'm going to go a 7 too. I agree with you on that.
72.
Well, a 7. Look, I think it's because of the other films, the great ones which did come after, which I think is why this drops down a little bit, because the other ones are so good.
Yes.
And it just goes to show you the caliber of what Hitchcock was as a filmmaker. He really was one of the best. But I think a 7, yes, I think the story is great. I think it does play out very well, suspense-wise. And I think it was such a brave choice to try and do this. And I think, you know...
And a very timely one.
And a very timely one, yeah. So yeah, definitely a 7 for me.
Snap. Now, on the assumption that we're doing this as one take wonder, I've done a bit of pre-work.
Yeah, sure.
And I've taken the usual bit of linking music we've got.
Really?
And I've put it on my phone. And I hope it works.
Yes.
So if you're listening to this, I want you to imagine that I haven't explained all this and now we're going straight from the scores to this. Perfect. So, would you like me to talk about the next film?
Yeah, I'd love you to talk about the next film. Okay. I can't believe you just did that.
We aim to please. Okay, so this is usually the point where Ricardo would say, Greg, would you like to tell us about our second film, Russian Ark? And I would say, sure, Ricardo.
Sure, yeah, go
so
for it.
Let me tell you about it. Now, I'm a bit caught out here because Russian Ark, normally when we talk about what the film is, that little synopsis, we usually give some kind of sense of the story. And the problem here is, this particular film, there really isn't a story in the classical sense. So the closest I can get to a story, after I've asked you if you're sitting comfortably, is to say, well, good, we'll begin. Once upon a time, there was a mythical place called Russia. And in Russia, there was a magnificent palace called the Hermitage. And one day, in a film, some dead people turned up and met other dead people across the palace for about an hour and a half without stopping a camera. So, Ricardo, what did you think of the film? Let's not get too self-congratulatory like those guys in Rope, but what did you think?
No, you know what? I found this to be absolutely boring as hell.
This is your first viewing, wasn't
it? This is my first viewing. Now, I was really looking forward to this. I have been wanting to see Russian Ark for a very long time because I heard it was an amazing film. It was just, you know, this phenomenal. You know, it was one take and it was just phenomenal going through this history. And I was really looking forward to this movie. I can admire it for its technical... I mean, technically, it is amazing, the movie. I mean, yes. Kudos to the cinematographer, to the director on this.
And to the Hermitage who commissioned the film in the first place.
Yeah, look, it really is a phenomenal achievement. But in terms of a film to watch, and I really feel like you have to be Russian and know Russian history to enjoy it. I think if I'd had known Russian history, I would probably enjoy it a lot more. This, you know, but really, I was honestly very, very bored throughout the movie.
Well, one thing this film wasn't doing was Russian.
No!
Hey, you just got that, okay. look, I feel the same. The big difference between your experience and mine is that I have seen this film before. Mm. So I went to the movies when it came out here in Melbourne and took a friend, who I don't think exactly thanked me for getting him to go. And I remember I fell asleep or came very close to falling asleep a number of times in this film. And I think it's for two reasons, one of which you've mentioned. The first reason is the one you mentioned, is that this is really a film that works if you understand its cultural and historical context. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And if anything, it makes me feel a bit guilty, but I don't. Because if they'd done this with like a French film, American film, Australian film, I would have got it.
Absolutely.
More.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the amount I know about Russian history and culture, I could probably just about write on a postcard.
Mm.
And so I don't get a lot of it. And I knew the first time I watched it that that was part of the problem. This time watching it, because I had more of a sense of, you know, how it played out, there was a bit more that I was picking up on. In some of the references. So towards the latter part of the film, you see a little series of vignettes around the last, you know, the doomed family of the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas and Alexandra, where the family and the children were taken to a cellar of a building. I don't think it's the Hermitage, it was somewhere else, the Winter Palace maybe, and then shot by the revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. And there was a long-running myth that Princess Anastasia, who I think was the youngest of the daughters, had survived. Right. Now, that was disproved relatively mm-hmm. recently, maybe since this film was made through DNA. They now know that she died for a long time. And in fact, there's an Ingrid Bergman film about, called, I think, Anastasia, about the fact that she might have survived. So that little bit I know. And so when this time some children had been playing, some girls, and came running up to the Tsarina Alexandra, and Alexandra says to her daughter, Anastasia, you know, where have you been? We've been looking for you all morning. Mm-hmm. I read that now as a joke about, or like a kind of arch reference to that little bit of history. Mm. And I suspect there's a lot more of that going on in the film, and you and I just aren't placed to get it.
No, I'm not. And I can appreciate, like, what I was really enjoying about it, you know, I was trying to find the enjoyment in it, was the artwork, was, you know, the just going around this beautiful, you know, place. I just thought that that's wonderful. One thing I didn't get into, and I thought I would a lot more, was just the performances of the historical characters. I thought I was watching an amateur theatre play, and overacting and people. And I think this is another. This is I talked about it before. I think this is where, you know, where the technical gets in the way of the actual what is going on screen. And you know, the feat of actually doing the one take, amazing. And this was actually one take. There was no trickery in this. It was actually one take.
Yes.
Which they had four goes
in it, but it ended up being one take.
Yeah, one take. And they had a day to do it. It was not less than a day. Yeah, and the, you know, a lot of setting up and everything for it. So kudos. Amazing.
They'd never rehearsed in the space before?
No, they hadn't, no. Mm. But still, I felt like it looked like people dressed up in costume, acting the parts in an amateur play, and they're going around and you know, now was my cue to do this. And it was, I didn't think that really worked that well. You know who I really admired in it?
Mm.
Who I really admired? I think he's one of the most amazing achievements, not just cinematographer-wise. I think the focus puller was one. It was an amazing achievement.
So you're going to explain that now to the rest of us.
Yes, I will. Okay, so the focus puller judges the distance between the camera and the subject and physically manipulating the lens on the camera to keep the said subject in focus. Okay, it sounds simple, but it is one of the hardest jobs in film. Okay? Your job is to keep, you've got your hand on, you have to judge the distance. So you know every camera movement and you have to keep the subject in focus. Now, what are we looking at on screen? We're looking at the characters. If they are out of focus, it's like bad sound. Okay, which everybody hates bad sound in movies.
And I assume part of what you're saying is that in a more traditional way of making a film, they draw the marks on the floor and know exactly where people will stand.
Well, they do, and they've got little marks.
They get to plan, do it a couple of times.
It's pretty much got a wheel, like a little wheel, which they mark from one section to another, so you can actually, and you can turn the wheel and it will go hit that mark and that will be in focus. So. And they've got a lot of marks on there for quite a few shots. But that's always one shot, you know, or even if it's a moving shot, it's only a shot for a few seconds or a minute or whatever. For the whole duration of an hour and a half, and it goes from wide to close up to feet
to up in the
to
air.
Up in the air. This film.
Right in on a couple of paintings.
Absolutely. Now,
across and back.
Now, let me tell you, this film is not on autofocus. So it would definitely have a focus puller on standby, you know, working on this thing. So I commend the focus puller on this completely. Well, what an amazing job.
I have to say that was perspective that would never have occurred to me. And seriously, I find that quite interesting.
Yeah.
I just want to come back to the second thing I think distances us from this film. So the first one being not having that cultural, historical background. The second one, and this film actually caused me to reflect back on the other two films, Rope and Birdman. Mm. In fact, this was the third of the three that I watched.
Yeah.
Was that when you become that clever with the camera work, to the point that we as the viewer, or to use our language, the watcher, is watching the film and now has an awareness of the making of the film rather than the film itself.
Mm.
The real risk is that can either pull you out of the story or distance you from the characters.
Mm.
And we're going to talk about Birdman. I think I don't like Birdman as much as I know you do. Certainly when you and I went to see it at the movies a few years ago. But I found that with Birdman, that I just never really engaged with the characters as much as I think I might have done, because part of me was always aware of, you know, how this film was being made as I watched it. And I certainly felt that way at this film as well. But I think what this has...
Well, so much of the marketing, though, is all about the technical achievement.
Yeah, I know, And that's really the way you got to see it.
And that's right. And so I think that's one of the issues, because you're constantly going there going, oh, my God, this was one take. And you're automatically trying to see how they did it and if you could see anything or any flaws or anything or how they've done this, you know. So.
And for me, that kind of thing, sometimes it works well. Like, I thought it worked really well in that sequence going into the nightclub in Boogie Nights.
Mm.
And I think I've spoken to you off podcast before about Atonement, where Atonement I was enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did that long, very tricky kind of tracking and moving around shot of the soldiers on the beach before an attack or they were attacking.
Dunkirk, yeah.
Dunkirk, yeah, thank you. I thought it was Dunkirk. For me, that was Too Clever by Heart, that I was so focused on what was going on here and how they were doing it and why were they even doing it. It pulled me right out of the story. I never got back into it.
I think that's a problem with Joe Wright films. I'm not a massive fan of Joe Wright.
He's the director of the time. Yeah.
I'm not a massive fan because I feel... Yeah, anyway, that's another podcast.
Yes.
But with Russian Ark, I just found, like I said before, the technical was amazing, but... In terms of watching it as a film, I didn't know Russian history, and I know that I would have loved it more had I done that. And I know a lot of people do love this movie and find it one a really fantastic, amazing film. You know, if I learn more about Russian history, I will watch it again. But...
Well, see, this is where I'm going to half disagree with you. I don't know that I will watch it again. I don't know I would have watched it again if we hadn't been planning it for this podcast. However, I think the distinction for me for Russian Ark against... For example, Birdman or even Rope. Birdman and Rope are telling a story.
Yeah.
Russian Ark's not really telling a story. It's tapping into other stories.
That's right.
And
it's confusing. It is quite confusing.
But I think in the end you have to go with it. And the risk is that you do fall asleep, and I was fighting sleep the second time around as well.
Oh, the lead guy, the European count. Yeah, was annoyed the absolute.
I was gonna ask you what you thought of him.
He just annoyed me.
But there are two things about it that really struck me as I watched about the experience rather than the story. Because I say the story is not something I can really tap into. But the experience, the first part of it was, it really was about dead people and dead people interacting with other dead people. There's a great little line at one point where the narrator, who's the voice of the director, who you never actually see, introduces the European to two friends of his in the modern day art gallery with the red walls. And he doesn't particularly want to engage with them. But at one point, he almost dismisses them by saying, "Oh, there's a funny smell here. Oh, it's formaldehyde." So these two guys have obviously died relatively recently. I don't know if they were real life characters, people or not. But there is a strong sense of these are ghosts that we're encountering. And particularly in the final sequences, when you go to the last great, I think it's the Winter Ball of 1913, and there are all those people there who, and not only they, but the event they're participating in is a ghost of the past, of a world that you and I can never really enter into, it's vanished. And then they're all leaving, they're having very mundane chit-chat as they go down these big staircases. And then you end up on that really quite extraordinary shot out the window of a semi-frozen ocean, or I don't know what it is, a snowdrift, that I think it's meant to be a body of water, so that it's emphasising that the Hermitage is the ark of the cultural and historical memories and artefacts. That for me, there is almost a melancholy of watching these ghosts and thinking, and that will be me one day. So although I would find it hard to go and watch that film again, because it is very long and languorous and in a lot of ways sleep-inducing, for me at least...
Oh, no, it is.
But not for people who would be happy with the story
no,
more.
No.
But I find that very interesting. And then the second thing is that if we look at this film, not, again, as story, but as spectacle, what I found myself thinking of was it was almost like an amusement park, a theme park ride.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, just before we sat down tonight, I've been talking to some friends who had just come back from the States and have been in a few amusement park rides, and some of the experiences they talked about reminded me of this film, because it's obviously in my mind tonight. And so some of the shots where the camera is kind of moving through the down the hallways and into rooms and going on funny patterns around the rooms, it's almost like we are on a ride, as the observers, through these historical recreations that are going on, almost like mannequins in a theme park, while we watch this happen. And I have to say, the two shots I really love in this film... One is the ending shot with looking out the window. But the other one is relatively early on that I remember when I saw it at the movies, I kind of went, wow, how did they do that? Where you come in the back door, backstage of this little theatre.
Yes.
And you end up seeing Catherine the Great directing the play that she's written. But to get from the backstage to her, you come up around the side of the stage, then through the actors' dances on the stage, and then you go up in the air and across the orchestra pit as they play, and then somehow we're down on terra firma. Now, I understand if you're making this film a different way, that they would cut, they'd have a shot with some kind of, you'll know the right phrase for this, some kind of almost like a zip line kind of thing across the orchestra pit.
Yeah.
But the fact that the camera for an hour and a half, and in the middle, or early in the hour and a half, goes from ground somehow around the space. I kind of get that, but then up in the air and across this other space and down again. I just sat there thinking, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is. And that's the thing, it is, you know. I mean, the fact that they could actually get the colouring right from indoors to outdoors.
Oh, they did play with colour later on.
They did, of course they did. They would have done that in the edit, obviously. But in terms of, you know, being able to, in terms of exposure and whatnot, go from, you know, interior to exterior.
And then back again.
And then back again. Is quite without you really noticing that there was any change whatsoever. Like I said, this is a really technical feat. I'm going to give it a score.
I don't want to go there yet. Because I want to come back to exactly what you're talking about. So they were fearful that, because they do that twice. They do it at the start of the film.
Yeah.
But they really do it when you see Catherine the Great the second time.
Yeah.
And they kind of follow her out of the street distance through the snow. And then he goes back inside to where the European guy is.
Yeah.
And they were fearful that what could happen was that when they went back inside, the lens would fog up. And it was much too late in the sequence to be able to do anything about it. So it's interesting to compare this to what you were saying just before about Hitchcock. Hitchcock achieved something marvellous within the technical limitations he had in 1948.
In one room.
Yeah, yeah. But also the 10-minute limit on the film stock.
That's right.
Here, they had a much better technology. It was made... it came out in 2002, so it was filmed in 01, 02.
Yeah, but it was digital,
But they started planning it in 1999, and even when they started planning it, they knew they didn't have the technology they needed. They had to go and find it, in some cases, kind of almost cause it to be invented. And one of those is lenses, that they found a lens that shouldn't have that problem, but kind of held their breath as they made that transition.
Mm. And they did it so well.
What would you give it?
I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why?
Because I think it is a technical marvel. I think it does deserve to be in, and I think it's not. I'm not the best person to judge the film because I don't know the Russian history or don't know it that well. And I think, you know, it is a Russian film. It is for the people for them a lot of the time.
Yep.
So I'm not going to judge it on that. But for me, I just think it's technically brilliant. I don't think it works that well as a film, but that's why I'm giving it a half. I'm going halfway.
Well, I'm giving it a 6. My reasons are relatively similar to yours. I would totally respect somebody who could tap more into the story and give it 10 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I'm not that person.
No, I'm not.
But I would totally get that. Mm. I think what they did is marvellous, technically, and the way they got there and how they almost didn't get there, which I've been sort of reading a bit about, I find deeply impressive.
And
the fact that it's now 15 years ago and no one's
attempted
or been able to achieve that.
No.
So it really is, I think, therefore a milestone in cinema.
It is.
But it's got all the problems that I as an individual have in terms of the history and accessing, you know, the story, that it ends up in places being quite soporific. And there are, you know, but at the same time, it's very interesting. If you kind of can have the discomfort of not having a story as such, then the way it sort of becomes this kind of coasting spectacle, almost like the way you behave in a gallery yourself. You know, you walk around, you zoom in on a picture here and there like the European does, and then you kind of move on. And often in the gallery, it's all too much. It's overwhelming. You can't take it all in. So I think there's a lot to recommend it. But I thought, do I give it a 10? But that's not my experience of the film.
No.
So for me, a 6.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think this is where I pick my phone up again, and I'm going to try and play our little patch music again. the marvels of modern technology.
Wow, that's all right.
So, 2 down, 1 to go.
That's right.
We're on the high wire, but we're going okay. And this is Ricardo's, where I say to you, so Ricardo, tell us about our third film, Birdman.
Okay, let's talk about Birdman. Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, tells the story of Regan Thompson, a washed-up actor famous for playing the superhero Birdman in 3 films many years ago. Struggling for critical acceptance, he decides to mount a Broadway adaptation of a short story. The film covers the period from the play's previews to the play's opening night. Regan Thompson, played with perfection by Michael Keaton, who ironically played Batman in the first 2 Tim Burton films.
Which is just delicious.
Yeah, that is tormented by the internal voice of his alter ego, Birdman. And the pressures of the show and critical success see him hallucinate, visualizing himself performing feats of levitation and telekinesis. With a fractured family life and failing career, this show has everything weighing on it. A life. Supported by an amazing cast who are all at the top of their game, including Emma Stone, a welcomed, restrained Zach Galifianakis,
yes,
Naomi Watts, and the very funny Edward Norton, this film is a visually brilliant look at a character at breaking point. Directed by Alejandro Iñárritu, he chose to shoot this film as though it was one take, which works so well in showing the fluidity of the character's mental state in decline. Obviously, digital technology nowadays allows the shot to do the impossible, gliding from interiors to exteriors effortlessly. Now, kudos has to be given to the cinematographer, Emmanuel Lubezki, and editors Douglas Cruz and Stefan Mironi for achieving the challenge presented to them. Now, the film won Best Picture at the 2014 Academy Awards, and, well, I don't think it's hard to see why. What do you think, Greg?
What do I think? Well, you and I have both seen this film before, and in fact, you and I saw it together with another friend of ours who's an actor and writer. And I remember that first time I saw it, that my experience of the film was very different to yours, and I think for two reasons. The first reason is that this film is very much of the world of theatre, and that's a world that you two understand and I don't. So there's less for me. In some ways, it's not dissimilar to Russian Ark. It's a story that I have more trouble entering.
Mm.
The second reason, this is purely about me, but we've talked before about, you know, your experience of a film is not just what's on the screen, it's what you bring to it, the context at the time and so on. And I had just been the prior week to see my first MA film in ages, which was the vile Kingsman Secret Service of Colin Firth.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which I hated, not least because I took two teenage boys to see it, not knowing what it was really like. And then the following week, we all went to see Birdman rated MA, and I was almost carrying a scar from that other film, so that when he does what on second viewing are really quite lovely lyrical scenes where he's flying through the cityscape in his flapping overcoat, when I first saw it, I kept waiting for the violent bit. I was waiting for him to crash and be a bloody mess on the pavement.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first time I saw it, for me, in some ways, was an unfair judgment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't love it. I still don't love it, but I like it more. But on the flip side of that opinion is that, again, in the context of this podcast, we were talking about the one-take wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that much more tuned into how did they do this. Again, I thought parts of that were clumsy.
I didn't think so in this. I thought, you know, look, yes, it is a device in this as well. And I think they used a lot of the time the pans, the whip pans, as it's panning along.
People walking through corridors?
Yeah, corridors. But even when they're walking outside and it was sort of the camera would sort of whip pan across something else and they would splice it there or go out of focus and use a motion blur to do that in the edit. So it was... And that sort of was
they weren't the clumsy ones for me.
No, they weren't the clumsy. Did you think the ones like they used when they're walking into a dark space, a bit like the rope?
And why it didn't work for me, there are about two or three of those, is that when they walked into the space and then they obviously cut, and then you see the person walking out into a more lit space like the interior of the bar.
Yeah.
That there was something not quite right about either the angle of the actor's back and shoulders and or the distance we were from them. Mm. It just, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but it just didn't quite work.
Oh, I thought it worked beautifully. I mean, you know which bits I think worked so well?
They were the more obvious ones.
I think doing the impossible was great, and so seamlessly, when it goes from the exterior through the grate in the window.
And some of them were so perfect.
The ones
when I knew rationally, that this is a cut, you know, I'm moving between two kind of set pieces when someone is walking down the corridor and turning corners.
Yes.
I knew, and I'm not sure I'm right actually, but I knew instinctively this is where one was happening, but I couldn't see it.
Mm.
And it's because most of the others were so well executed, the dark space Hitchcock rope technique, which again didn't quite work for me, kind of undermined that a bit.
I think that was a bit of a homage. I think that was, you know,
oh, do
to,
you?
To, I think it was, yeah.
To Hitchcock?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But in terms of a film, I think, you know, there's a reason you should do the one take device. I think Rope did it, didn't really, that story didn't have to be a one-take film. Okay, that could have been shot anyway, and it would have probably been just as good. Russian Ark was a device, but again, I think that it worked. They did it for that purpose, to glide through a museum and look at all the different parts of history throughout the museum. I think there's a reason to do it. And I think Birdman is showing a fluid decline of a character at breaking point. I think it's a very... It uses the device well for the story.
Yes, and see, I actually have the opposite experience. Mm. Again, because I'm so focused on the way the story is being told, and because I don't particularly relate to this world to begin with, I never really bought into the story. I didn't deeply care, I didn't particularly care about the characters. Whereas I think you had the opposite entry point to me.
Look, I cracked up laughing at the very beginning when that actor gets the light drops on his head.
Yeah.
Because I worked in the theatre for 11 years, backstage at the Victorian Arts Centre. So I worked on all the operas and the stage pieces there. And so it was, you know, I know all lights are chained, right? So that doesn't happen, but it's always a thing which could happen, you know, and so it does happen there. So there's little devices there I really like.
So is this film really for a specialist audience then?
Oh, it might be.
Like Russian Ark.
It really might be. Look, I love it for that. I love it for the filmmaking qualities, but also that I know the world. So
yes.
it helps, you know, I think it helps a lot. But it's interesting because, you know, how I was going on about theatre and the theatre acting for, you know, for this sort of take? How things can be very, like you're watching a theatre show.
Yeah.
This is quite the opposite. Now, in a theatre, like, you know, when they're doing the performances and Michael Keaton's on the stage and he's doing all the performances, I'm thinking to myself, well, he's actually film acting on stage.
Yeah.
Which is completely opposite. The audience would hardly hear any of his lines sometimes. Sometimes he's like, he's to the audience and it's all fine. But sometimes when he's talking, he's talking really soft and as if he's film acting, because obviously it's for the film. But I'm thinking, the audience would not hear a word he is saying. And so it's the opposite.
Yeah? Again, that would never occur to me.
Yeah.
And again, so who was the film for? There were some things I got, and I think you would have got more deeply.
I've worked as an actor for many years, as well as backstage. I've worked in
the
film.
The Edward Norton character, as well as being really obnoxious, is a very funny character.
Yes,
And I kind of can, I guess, intuit what Norton is playing there as, you know, real examples of actors. You know,
yeah.
And you would totally get that, and I kind of get that.
Yeah.
And for me... Birdman, and you and I have talked about this briefly before, Birdman is a film that, like, I think, La La Land and the French film The Artist, two of which, and probably the third, have cleaned up at the Academy Awards, has, and I'm not saying this is a conscious act, but has as its voting public the people that the film is about and who can really get into it. But it doesn't necessarily make it a great film for the rest of us.
I think using Michael Keaton as the lead character of this is a masterstroke.
Oh, it's inspired.
Right, it really is.
The Batman, whose career went nowhere for a long, long time.
A long, long time. And this is his renaissance.
Yes.
Here, which, and the play ends up being his renaissance as well. So, yes. You know, it's a... I think it's a masterstroke, and I think he's absolutely... I've always been a big fan of Michael Keaton, and for even Johnny Dangerously way back when, and I think he's wonderful. I think he's so good in this. I loved every moment of his performance.
And again, I can respect... And respect is too clinical a term, but I can respect his performance. I can respect Edward Norton's performance. I really like the performance, even though she's only... briefly twice, of the woman who played his wife or ex-wife.
Yeah, yeah, she was lovely.
I just thought that was a really nice, grounded, sympathetic, but not hero-worshipping or, you know, bitter ex-wife kind of character.
Well, Emma Stone's wonderful. I mean, everybody's wonderful. Like I was saying, Zach Galifianakis was a really good surprise because he's so usually doing the weird comic.
The Hangover guy.
Yeah. And even Between Two Ferns, which is his YouTube thing, he's quite a weird sort of character. Whereas here he was quite restrained, and I really liked his performance in it as well. Naomi Watts is always amazing. I mean, she's... You know, Naomi. You know.
And there are a couple of shots or sequences that I really enjoyed. Like, you know, the second time around, the flying through the streets, once I realised he was going to crash and burn.
Yeah.
So the flying through, and even when he flies into that kind of archway road tunnel,
yes.
I'm thinking, yeah, so how did they do that? That was really quite lyrical.
Yeah.
I like the opening shot where he's hovering in his dressing room in his undies.
I love it.
We see him behind. He's just kind of floating there in his daggy white Y-fronts. And I like the scene just before the flying sequence, where he's walking down the road, we finally see the Birdman character rather than just hear his voice.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I was thinking, is that actually played by Michael Keaton with a bit of clever CGI? But it's a different actor, but he's using that very gravelly Batman voice.
Yeah,
it's now almost a cliche. But then suddenly the street erupts in the worst kind of Hollywood CGI.
Shrieking
vulture birds and explosions and alien robots or whatever was flying around in space there. You know, well, as the commentary of what he tried to leave behind.
He's about to... He's suicidal. So this is crack. He's cracked completely, right? And this is where I think it's done so well. And this is where I'll get to the end shot in a second, because...
Just be careful what you say about it for those who haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I can't. I've got to talk about it because it ruins it a little bit. So...
I know. You mean where she looks?
Yes, absolutely. So... all the way through the film, it sort of goes between his reality and fantasy really well.
And you're not quite sure if it's fantasy or not.
Absolutely. But you know, after the whole nice bit when he's floating around in New York City and he goes through the tunnels and all the rest of it, he arrives back at the theatre.
Yes.
And then you see a cab driver...
Go chasing him
for the money.
Yeah.
Things like that are so well done because obviously it is in his fantasy. But there's an end shot. Now, I won't talk about it too much, but it annoyed me because it was sort of like, am I meant to believe that this has all been real
or not? It's enough to say that in the very last shot, Emma Stone looks out a window.
That's right.
And the direction she looks makes it hard to understand what's going on.
Again. Yeah, and whether... I mean, I don't believe he's flying. I mean, I don't. I think the other, it did it so well throughout the whole film to sort of separate the two. Then it sort of tried to mesh them together. I don't know.
But then you could read it as the fact that she's now entering his fantasy.
Possibly. But she has never done it throughout the whole film.
But
I don't know.
I know.
And they've just started to bond again. I understand that. So, you know. But anyway, have a look at it and, you know, make up your own mind. But to me, it was like, oh, no, why? Why did you do that? Oh, it just frustrated me a bit. But because I love the film.
Can I just point out one other in-joke in the film? So relatively early in the film, someone's talking about the fact that Martin Scorsese's in the audience. And he is.
No, he's not.
Yes, the scene where...
He's not.
Not then. The scene where he locks himself out of the theatre in his white fronts, his undies...
Yes.
And has to go round the outside and then comes into the audience. This commentary I read said Scorsese is actually in the audience at that time. So I went back and I tracked it. And I think I know, I'll need to show you because you'll know for sure if it's him or not. But apparently, it's like a little in-joke. At that moment, he is in the audience himself.
I saw a character outside the theatre, which I thought looked like him, but I don't think it is.
We might have to take this offline afterwards and check. And you, the listener, you can do this too and just double check.
If it is, that's fantastic.
Yes, if it is.
Right. But that whole Times Square sequence was amazingly done the way they did that because Michael Keaton locks himself out of the theatre and walks...
At the stage door.
And has to run right outside the theatre and walk all the way through Times Square in his underpants and then walk back into the theatre ready to do his scene. And it's a fantastic sequence. Now, they did that without... No one knew at Times Square that they were going to do that. So they put drummers and a band outside the band. You know, there's a whole band. So he walks past the band doing the drumming of the band to make people not sort of look over and see what was going on.
Oh.
And to mask it all. But all the people in the background, that is Times Square at nighttime, and they just filmed around it.
Well, the other layer of meaning that I read about, and I need to go back and look at it again, is the use of the mask of the Phantom of the Opera from Andrew Lloyd Webber in the film.
Mm.
So in a lot of the early part of the film, until he has his big crack up and goes flying,
you
see that poster in a lot of places, you know, the masked character.
Mm.
But after that sequence, starting with when the cab driver goes in chasing after his money, you only see that as a reflection. And so one hypothesis about the film is that that's actually meant to be like a visual language or a symbol about where this character sits either side of that, you know, central event.
Mm.
So coming to scores, where are you on this one?
Look, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
I really love it. I do really love it for all the reasons I've said. I think it's a great move, great performances. I really love the story. Like I said, I know the world, so I got into it. I'll watch it again. Loved it.
For me, you got an 8, didn't you?
Yeah.
For me, it's a 7. The first time I saw it, I would have marked it lower, maybe a 5 or a 6, but partly because of the baggage that I think I brought to that
video. Oh, I would have gone, oh!
Yeah, well, we're now back to cabaret territory from last year.
I hope you've changed your mind on that one there.
Let's not go there.
I really hope you've changed your mind on that one there, Jeepers.
But I'd lost that baggage this time around. It was interesting to watch it in the context of these three films and what was done and how it was done. For me, again, I don't really quite enter the story. I can admire it, but I don't really engage with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I do think there's a little bit of clumsiness there, but I am struck by your argument about maybe that was a deliberate, you know, homage to Hitchcock, in which case, that's quite nice.
Yeah.
And given if it's what I've just said is true about the Scorsese appearance and the Phantom of the Opera mask, which may or may not be true, then to me that's kind of like, well, actually that's another really cute, not cute, a really good element of the film.
Mm.
But for me, it sits on a 7.
Yeah.
So let me just get reach to my musical little tech box here. Hang on. Well, that just gets better each time. Well, this is the point where normally we talk about next time.
That's right.
So in our next episode, mm-hmm. we are intrigued, I guess driven by the recent film La La Land, which has provoked conversation between ourselves and also people around us.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say too much about my response to the film yet, but La La Land has led us to think about what's been done that's maybe a bit different in musicals. So, yeah. What do we call it? Modern musicals with a twist, or mm-hmm. you know, reinventing the musicals.
Modern musicals, really.
Yes, yeah. Okay. So obviously one of those would be La La Land,
yeah.
which is a bit of a scary concept because this is probably the first time we're talking about a film that's actually still on the cinema release.
I know, it's actually quite a new thing for us.
I think we're getting dangerous as we go forward.
Yeah.
It's obviously this tightrope act we're doing today in terms of, you know, the one, what do we call it, one-take wonders.
One-take wonder. Yeah.
So the second film we're doing is also quite a recent film called The Last 5 Years. Mm. In 2014 with Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan. And the third film?
The third film we're going to be doing is a film which was made in 2000. It was with Bjork called Dancer in the Dark. I think that's a really interesting take on a musical as well.
And we've both seen La La Land. You have seen Dancer in the Dark?
Yeah, but I saw it many years ago.
And I've seen The Last 5 Years, which will be new for you.
Which I haven't seen that either.
So that's where we're going. Mm-hmm. So we're going from our high wire act, which has been fun tonight.
Yeah, it's been fun. I hope you've enjoyed our one take wonder. We've done it all in one take, no cuts at all. So that's quite interesting.
it has been, and not without a little bit of pressure. But at least, unlike other times where sometimes we get the giggles or dry up, at least we managed to keep going all the way through.
We did.
We should get our own Oscar for that. Anyway, so join us next time for episode 4 of season 2, which is the modern musical.
That's right. And thank you very much for listening.
And at this stage, Ricardo will actually cut in our real finishing music.
Da 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 da.
No, put it in.